the UCR Podcast.
Here's one for fans of hard rock and heavy metal. Blackie Lawless of Wasp joins us today. Wasp will return to the road this fall for another epic outing, this time under the banner of 1984 to Headless. They'll be focusing on songs from the first four albums, with KK's Priest also part of the bill, so it should be a pretty incredible evening. The tour kicks off September 10th in California. You can find all of the dates at WaspNation.com, as well as details on VIP packages. In today's conversation, Blackie shares how an interesting project has helped to inform the scope of the upcoming run, because we're talking with him about his memoir, which he's been working on for about 5 years. He shares the working title that he's using for the book, as well as the overall journey he's taken as a result of researching the project. By the way, as a bonus, you'll also hear my previous conversation with Blackie from June of 2024, which goes further into the history of the group, and particularly the early years of the band, and also their first album. It's Matt Wardlaw. Thanks for checking out the UCR Podcast. If this is your first time listening, follow us wherever you're joining in so that you'll receive future episodes as they're released. And if you dig what you're hearing, please leave us a review. Don't forget that we are writing about Wasp and a lot of your favorite artists and bands at the UCR website. And if you've got some albums that have gone missing from your collection over the years, or simply some new ones that you'd like to add, you can do all of that at store.ultimateclassicrock.com. Use my discount code WARDLAW15 to get 15% off your order. All right, let's get into it. Here's our conversation with Blackie Lawless. Enjoy. The last time we spoke, you made an important point that underlined, I think, how seriously you still feel about making records. And you said, every record we do now, it's about the legacy. And you said you weren't going to pour what you had at that point down the drain, but the record you had taking shape wasn't a cohesive thing as far as where you wanted to be at. So that was June of 2024, and you've certainly been busy with all sorts of things since then. But where is your head at presently? What's happening as far as new music and, you know, a record and that kind of thing?
Well, to be honest with you, I went back, after we came back from the last European tour, which was in November, you know, I took a little time over the holidays. And so I went back and I listened to what we had done. And I'm still about in the same place I was, and I'm not really thrilled with where it is. I just think that there's so much more that can be had. But I'll be further honest with you. My head has really been into this book that I've been working on.
Yeah.
And it's like it's really consumed most of my time. And it's been way more work than I ever thought it was going to be. It's easily as much work as making a record, but probably more, because I've been working on this now for 5 years. And since we came home last November, I have really, really buckled down and started working on this. I'm probably halfway done now, but the amount of research that it took to get a lot of these stories correct is really time consuming. And I find that there will be times where it'll take me 6-7 hours to write two paragraphs because of the amount of research that's going on. Because when I first started this, like probably everybody else, I would have thought it would have been my singular story. And that seemed reasonable at the time. But the more I got into it, the more I realized it was not just my story, that because the title of the book is called Tales from the Square Mile. And what it's about is that square mile that I was living in Hollywood at the time, and the influences that the town itself would have on not just me, but the music industry and overall. And we are all tied to it, whether we know it or not. You know, because the way the movie studio systems were set up in the 20s, 30s, and 40s had a direct influence on what the record companies would be later. So all this research, like I said, that went into uncovering a lot of what I've been doing has just taken an enormous amount of time. But the little nuggets that I've discovered that I think people will find interesting, for me, were fascinating when I would uncover them. So, and there's a lot of goofy coincidences that have happened in it too, you know, the things that have been uncovered. So, like I said, I think it's going to be an interesting read when people see it. It's not going to be your typical rock and roll book by any stretch.
That's fantastic. You know, I think the thing is, a lot of guys like yourself are in that position through, in this case, through the 80s and so on, where you're doing the work. So I would imagine, like, what's been the most enlightening thing for you as you've taken stock of everything that was really kind of going on?
Oh, man. Well, it ends up, when you write a book, especially something like this, you realize you saved yourself about 40 years of being on a psychiatrist's couch, because the holes, the rabbit holes that you have to go down, because it's really revealing, because we have surface memory of events that have happened in our lives. But it's not until we go to really start digging deeper at any specific event that might have happened in your life. You think you remember it, and you do on the surface, but it's not until you start really going back to wherever that event may have happened in your head, and you start looking and visualizing everything that was going on at the time. And man, I'm here to tell you, there's a lot of stones that you uncover that some are good and some are not so good. And I've come to the understanding that this is not a book I could have written 20 years ago, because I wasn't in the headspace to write it. You know, so it's been, as the old Grateful Dead song says, what a long, strange trip it's been. It's been that.
Here's the last book question. And that just is, what have been the hardest dots for you to connect? There's always kind of gaps. Like, what's been kind of the area that was a challenge, perhaps?
Childhood.
Oh, yeah. I get that.
Yeah, because that, too, is where you start going down these rabbit holes, and things that you think, you know, it reminds me of the old Peter Gabriel song, Digging in the Dirt to Find the Places Where We Got Hurt. You know, my dad was in the construction business, and we traveled a lot when I was a kid. I ended up going to 13 different schools by the time I graduated. So I was constantly the new kid. And it's hard to make friends, and the friends you do make, you know, as soon as you make them, you're gone again. And that ended up having quite a bit more of an impact on me, you know, growing up, than even I gave it credit for. You know, and it's like you're constantly, as men, you know, or as boys, we were constantly being tested by the older kids and stuff like that. So there was a lot of brutality that went on with it. But I would say, in a word, childhood.
I think it's interesting, because I think we've seen this with your work over the years, but it seems like you reference, like, the Grateful Dead, what a long, strange trip it's been. But then you also reference Peter Gabriel's Digging in the Dirt. And, you know, we've seen you over the years, like, you know, cover, like, I Don't Need No Doctor. And obviously The Real Me was, you know, part of The Headless Children. So it seems like through all the years, like, some folks aren't able to do this, but it seems like you were able to remain a music fan even as you were deep into making music yourself.
Oh, yeah, huge. I mean, I'm in a place right now where, like a lot of guitar players, although I'm a singer, which the world knows me for, I'm a guitar player by trade. And I have been just inundated with going back to visiting my blues roots, you know, because I would, and people might find this strange to hear, but I would say probably at least 80% of everything that this band has ever done or I've ever written has been either blues or rhythm and blues based. And I know that might sound strange for people to hear, but I know where the roots of it are, and I know where that stuff came from. So for me to go back to revisiting all this stuff again is a natural cycle for me. So I mean, that's all I've been listening to for the last 6 months.
I think that makes sense, though, because it's the classic creative challenge for you. It's like, how do I take what I love and turn it into something new? And obviously what you did is you turned that into Wasp.
Well, I've also had the joy of rediscovering music, because, you know, I tell the old joke about, people say, well, what kind of music do you listen to? And I say, well, it's a little like being a car mechanic. And if you work on brakes all day, do you want to go home and work on your own brakes? Probably not.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, this is not that. This is, you know, like I said, when you get deep into, like, where I'm at right now, listening to blues stuff and really appreciating what these guys had created before us, because without it, it is the foundation of rock and roll, and all the music that we listen to, heavy rock, now all of it all stems from that source. So to go back and to rediscover it, I kid you not, I feel like I'm in my teens again, you know, because the joy that it would give me when I listen to it, I can't really put it into words, the joy that it's giving me doing this. After you do it for a long time, people have a tendency to get jaded and biased, and they lose a lot of that. And I went through that too as well. And you wonder, you know, if it'll ever come back, and you think it probably won't because you probably moved on. But for me, fortunately, like I said, it's been a phenomenal rediscovery.
When it comes to this upcoming 1984 to Headless Run, how does the process of doing the book, how has that informed a project like mapping out something like this tour? And, you know, I think you could probably, you know, say that it, you know, tied into the tour that you did where you were, you know, revisiting the entire first record. I'm sure that the two things inform each other in very interesting ways.
They do. They do. You know, and you're correct that in writing the book, it takes you, because again, we're dealing most of the time in our day-to-day lives with surface memory. When you start digging deep and you start going into those little wormholes, and it takes you back to events and places and people, you know, things you've forgotten about. And it also helps to have friends around who were around when a lot of that was going on too, because they can remind you of things, because we've seen so much in our lives that we forget, you know, a lot of the things that are seemingly smaller. But somebody that was there will come along and say, "Hey man, you know, remember such and such, da 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 da," and you go, "Oh yeah, shit, I forgot all about that." You know, and it's like it will then again, it'll take you into a different direction, sometimes into a completely different room where you discover all kinds of things that you had absolutely forgotten about. So it too transcends when you're starting to put a tour together like that too, because it helps you to really understand where your mindset was when you made that record at that time. So it's a big help.
I like that you've got KK's Priest on this upcoming run. What's the point where you kind of recall first crossing paths with KK and Judas Priest back in the day?
Well, you know, we had done festivals with them over the years and stuff, but we did a festival with him and his band about 2 years ago in Spain, and my trailer was right behind the stage where they were playing, and they went on, and I could hear them clear as a bell, and I'm here to tell you, those boys play those songs, and that kid Ripper singing those things, man, that guy's got it down. I mean, it's like it is literally a mirrored reflection of that band in their heyday. Those boys know how to play those songs. And as a singer, I got my work cut out for me going toe to toe with that guy every night. That's for sure.
Well, and as a guitar player, it's pretty inspiring to see KK playing at the level that he is. Like he
Absolutely.
steps out there and just turns into the guy.
Oh, yeah. You know, and you look at it and you realize that's the guy that wrote those songs. And for me as a songwriter, you know, there's always going to be specific relevance for that. You know, for me, I can't not see that.
Thinking of you guys and Judas Priest made me wonder at what point things started to feel competitive between you and the rest of the hard rock and heavy metal world with Wasp versus everything else that was going on back in the day. Because like you had such a incredible journey just getting that first album out of the world. So I have to imagine it's a pretty interesting point when you start to realize like we're a major player in all this now.
I don't see it as being competitive though with other people. The only competition I see is it's internal. You know, it's like running a race. You know, you don't run the race to beat the guy next to you, because you know, if he's got a bad leg, you know, and you beat him, then what have you accomplished? You run that race for time to be the best that you can be. Can you beat the time that you had yesterday? You know, that's what it's all about. You know, so you don't really, in trying to compare yourself to anyone else is a waste of time. You know, it's you got to be the best you can be and keep constantly trying to raise that bar.
That makes sense. It just also makes sense that you were constantly trying to raise the bar, and you see that when you look at the pace of how quickly those first three records came out, boom, 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 you know, across 3 years. I mean, it's got to be pretty incredible to you to see that now, you know, just the pace at which you guys were, you know, rolling.
Well, I've always said that the first 5 years of any band is where they make their bones, because if you think back to any band you like that you're a fan of, in almost every case, it's those first 5 years and the records that they make in that time period that cements them or not as far as their legacy of what they're going to have going forward. And we're no different. You know, it's, if you look at, I mean, there are exceptions, and that doesn't mean that you can't make great records after those first 5 years, but that those first five are the ones that really solidify the fan base inside their heads as to whether they're going to, you know, devote themselves to you and be a lifelong fan or not. You know, I mean, in my particular case, you know, that first 5 years would have ended with Headless, and certainly the Crimson Idol after that, you know, was a different milestone. But, and that's, you know, a different discussion for another day. But I also think that those first 5 years, in my case, helped me build towards making something like The Idol later, because without making those first few records, The Idol never happens.
I think there is kind of a connection, though, between Headless Children and The Idol record. They both feel linked in the sense that they both felt really ambitious, like you were putting the pedal to the floor, pushing the proverbial envelope. I think this happens just with everything you do creatively with each record. You know, once you see where you got with that record, that just gives you further fuel for the next one. But it really seemed to, like those first few records, as you say, really fueled the next part of the journey in a really interesting way.
Oh, they do, because, you know, those are the ones, again, those first 5 years, that's what sets the imagination on fire of the fan base. I mean, me being a fan, I can think back to all the bands that I liked, and it was those first 5 years. You know, and again, that's not to say that they can't make great records later, but we all know, you know, that romance period that we have with a band when they first come out. And if they have staying power, they're going to show you within those first 5 years that they're going to be a force to reckon with for decades to come.
Well, last couple things here. We talked last time about the Blind in Texas video. I wanted to kind of just dig into your memory banks a little bit as far as working on the video for Wild Child. Take me back to that that time period.
Well, they were both done right around the same time.
Exactly.
And, you know, that too was a period where you said something just a second ago about the first few records that were made and the pace that they were made at. You got to remember, when you're a new band, you know, everybody talks about the sophomore jinx, where a band will come out with their first record, but they can never top it after that. And what happens is you have labels that are putting incredible pressure on these new artists when they first come out. And the story that you hear over and over and over from the label is that you got to get out there. You got to make this record quick, and you got to get back out there. If you don't, the fans are going to forget about you. They're going to never know you existed. And you, as a young artist, because you see them as having been successful. In my particular case, it was Capital EMI. You know, this is where the Fab Four lived, you know, so it's like they must know all and see all. But what happens is that when we made our second record, from the time we started pre-production, it was 7 weeks to the time we started pre-production to that record was finished and in the can, and we were back out on the road again. The same thing happened when we made the third record. And what you realize is that you do a record and a tour and a record and a tour and a record and a tour. By the time you're finished, you don't know who you are anymore in that cycle. And you literally need time to stop and reflect. And a great, one of the byproducts that happened during that period, when we were doing the Inside the Electric Circus tour, we were touring with Maiden, and they were doing Somewhere in Time. And what neither band realized at that time until we got out on the road, because, you know, we're under the same umbrella, managed by the same management company, all that. So it's a real family-like environment. And what we didn't realize until we got out there is that both bands were not happy with the records that they had made. And the reason we weren't happy with them is because of the pace, that treadmill that we had been on for the longest time. And so during the course of that tour, we all made a conscious decision where we said, you know what, we're not listening to the labels anymore. We're going to take a little time. We're going to reflect. We're going to go right. And we're going to make the best records that we can make. And you know what? And if the world forgets about us, then so be it. But at least we're going to go down doing what we believe is best. But the thing that I discovered was that when the labels were saying, if you don't get out there quick, the world's going to forget about you. The world will forget about you if you start making bad records. That's really the criteria right there. It's not how quickly you can get out there. See, you have to remember that they've got quarterly statements that they have to answer to and all that stuff. So they're looking at the bottom line, and they've got somebody ready to take your place if you start making bad records. So you have to look out for yourself to make the best records you can. And that was really the turning point right there, because if you look at the difference between what the earlier records that we had made and by the time we made Headless, that was a band who had already toured the world two or three times. We had seen everything, done everything already at that point. And our vantage point from the things we were seeing in the world was completely different. You're no longer the same person. I could not write I Want to Be Somebody Again if I wanted to, or Love Machine. You know, it's just because you're not that person anymore. You know, so it's like, you know, Marvin Gaye said it the best. He says, make the records that reflect who you are at that moment in your life. Don't try to worry about what's hot on the charts or what you think the flavor of the month is. Write what you are experiencing at that time. And that's really what we did.
Well, Blackie, always a pleasure to talk music with you. We'll look forward to, how far do you think we're from the book? You said about half done?
Well, I'm halfway, but
yeah,
I'm hoping, and I got my fingers crossed for this, I'm hoping it's done before the year's out.
Wow.
Oh, you know, I mean, we've got a lot of stuff, but those first, back to the 5-year scenario again, the first 5 years of me doing this book was doing a lot of research. Now I'm at a point where I feel like I can start to sprint with it. A lot of the things that I did that took all the time to uncover the research, that's been done now. So now I can just, you know, get into the daily process of writing, and it's starting to go pretty quick now.
Well, awesome, man. Can't wait. Can't wait to see the show. Thank you for the time, man.
Thanks, buddy, for having me. I really appreciate it, bud.
You got it, man. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's Matt Wardlaw. Hopefully you enjoyed that conversation with Blackie Lawless, which was recorded earlier this week. Now, as promised, here is my previous discussion with Blackie, recorded in June of 2024. Enjoy. Where I wanted to start, obviously, the big news is you're going to be playing the first album in full this fall. And like so many bands do with their first record, like it seems like you took quite a journey from the time you started to conceptualize the songs to the moment where it finally hits the shelves. But you had a long journey with Circus Circus, the things that even led up to the formation of the band. So I wonder, like, what's the moment where you felt like you really had something with this project that had become known as Wasp, like song-wise or otherwise? Like, what's the moment that you pinpoint where you felt like things were falling into the right place?
Well, you know, that's a really, really good question, because, man, in the 14,000-plus interviews that I've done in my career, no one has ever asked that question, and I'll tell you why. And it's not just because of what we're talking about right now. This applies to any band or any artist. There's a thing that happens, and I've seen it over and over and over with other artists. They will, you know, everybody starts out writing songs, and they all stink, right? I mean, nobody gets it right off the bat. It's a craft. You start to develop it. Some get better, some don't. But the ones who get better, they will go through a period. And it is astonishing, because, like I said, I've seen this with a number of different cases where it's not happening, it's not working, and it's just not working. And then all of a sudden something clicks. And there's like a graduation process that happens in that writer's brain. And once they move into that new space, people are astonished that knew them prior to it, because they think to themselves, you know, there's a fluidity that's coming out of this person now. How come that wasn't happening before?
Yeah.
And like I said, I've seen this with, it's happened with myself, you know, and, you know, many, many other huge artists that you would, I mean, look at Lennon and McCartney, you know, they couldn't give their stuff away. And then all of a sudden, you know, the first couple of things that happen, and then this floodgate opens. And like I said, they're probably the rule and not the exception, you know, when it comes to success. So I'm saying all that to say this, that before the band got together, it was only about a year that I wrote that batch of songs prior to that. And it took off from there. You know, so it's just, you reach a, or you have a growth spurt, you know, where things just start to click into your head and it's like, it all starts to make sense. And then the songs start to reveal themselves. And that's another thing with the songwriting process. You learn after a while, when songs really start to take shape, you know, a good tunesmith will get out of the way and let that thing go where it wants to go. It'll tell you where it wants to go. You just got to be smart enough to listen.
It's always interesting for somebody like you going back to a record like this. I wonder, like, what are the songs that have really hit you personally going back to this album?
I don't know if it's any one thing. It's, to me, it's, you know, it's a, if you look at all of it as a combined work, what it really means to me is looking back at who I was at the time, because, you know, I've said, and I didn't know in the beginning, but as my career moved on and I look back at it, I realized it was an angry record done by an angry band. Hmm. You know, I mean, you talk about guys who are pissed off at the world. And that's what made our live show so convincing, because we didn't feel that we were doing anything out of the ordinary for us. You know, you always hear the old show business expression, just be yourself. Well, that's what we were doing. And it wasn't until we were making the Headless record, which was like 5 years down the road. And I went into a bar one night, or a restaurant, and they were playing the video from the Live at the Lyceum in there. And I sat down, I hadn't seen it since we did it. And I watched it for just a few minutes, and I was stunned. Absolutely stunned at what I was looking at who I was looking at, because I didn't recognize myself, you know, because as an artist, you grow, you change. It's, you know, it's like I said, you know, it was an angry record by an angry band. Well, it's hard to be pissed off at the world a few years down the road when you're driving Ferraris around, you know, it just, it doesn't, you know, it always reminds me of the movie Rocky III, where Rocky wants to fight Mr. T, and Burgess Meredith, his manager, tells him he doesn't want him to do it, and he tells him he can't beat Mr. T, and Stallone says, well, why not? And Burgess Meredith said, kid, the worst thing that can happen to any fighter happened to you. You got civilized. You know, well, that's what happens when success comes in, you know, and it's like, it's hard, you know, to write about your angst, you know, when your world is just radically different. And like I said, these are not things that are new. I mean, you've heard this song and dance over and over and over.
Sure.
So really, you know, when we were making the first record, it was on a Sunday, and the engineer came in. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was the only one from the band there yet. And this guy, he was the kind of guy who was always kind of bubbly and always had some jokes going on or something. And he came in this day, and he was pretty quiet. He wasn't saying much. And after about an hour, you know, I said to him, hey, man, what gives? You know, you're not yourself. Is something wrong? He said, I got a phone call before I came in today. Marvin Gaye was murdered last night, and he told me that he had made two records with Marvin.
Oh, man.
So I could tell that, you know, he just needed to talk, right? So we shut everything down, and we just talked for about an hour. And out of that entire conversation, what I got out of it was something he said, you know, Marvin made records. He didn't care about what was hot on the charts. He didn't care about, you know, what he thought, you know, was going to sell or anything. He made records that reflected who he was at the moment. And boy, when he said that, that was like, you know, that was one of those pivotal moments for me. You know, it's like I wrote that down, you know, in the front of my skull and never forgot it, because that's really, if you're going to be a true artist and you're going to take people on a lifelong journey, and I'm not talking about 5 or 10 years, I'm talking about 20, 30 years, you know,
yeah.
If you're going to do it for that long, you have to make records that are authentic to who you are. And if you're going to speak to that fan base, you can't keep selling them something that you're not. You have to reflect who you are at that moment. Because every time you do a new record, what you're doing, in effect, is you're speaking to them. And what you're saying to them is, hey, this is what I'm thinking now. You know, I was thinking this before, but this is what I'm thinking at the moment. How you guys doing? You know, what are you thinking? Can you relate to this? You know, does it speak to you? You know, but whether it does or it doesn't, the only authentic way of communication is writing about who you are at that moment.
And how much does that authenticity of, say, this first record still land with you personally now?
Well, like I said, it's a chapter of my life, and it does take me back, but it doesn't take me back so much to the recording process. I mean, that's inevitable. You're going to think about some of that, but more than anything, it was about the writing process itself. So when you asked what you did in that first question, it kind of struck a nerve with me, you know, because that's, for me, that was really what it was all about. Where was I when that was all taking place?
Yeah.
And, you know, who was I at that moment?
You mentioned the live show, and that's something you've always put so much thought into, the staging, you know, of the show itself. Like, so how did you, what do you recall about conceptualizing the initial, like, live shows that the band was doing?
Well, you got to remember, when we first got together, we had no intention of ever playing live.
Right.
You know, we had been in LA long enough to know that the way you got a record deal was by doing the best demo tape you could do. Well, we did the demo tapes, and we shopped them around, and 6 weeks went by and we weren't getting any response. And knowing, having lived in this town for so long, you know that if you haven't heard something in 6 weeks, you're probably not going to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's plenty enough time. If a label's hot, you know, on working with you, they're going to let you know pretty quick. So 6 weeks was certainly plenty of time. So we said, well, you know, we think this record is pretty good. Why don't we take it out and try it in front of people and see what kind of reaction we get? Well, then the next question was, all right, then what do? You know, do we stand there and get arrested for loitering, or do we do some sort of presentation? And the unanimous decision was we were going to entertain ourselves. And that's what we did. And lo and behold, it started growing in leaps and bounds, and so did the crowds. And, you know, we went from playing the Troubadour on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, which is the worst spot of the week because they're closed on Monday. Hmm. You know, so we went from playing that Tuesday night slot to 11 months later doing the Santa Monica Civic, you know, without a record deal, without a manager, nothing, just us.
So what was the thing that, like, you know, how did you get the record deal with Capitol?
Well, we had some serious interest from some other smaller labels. There was a label here called Enigma, and it was Wes and Bill Hine, two brothers.
Sure.
They were going to mortgage their house because we told them we needed a minimum of $75,000, which at the time for an independent was a lot of money. Still is, actually, but that was a lot of money for an independent label back then. And Capitol, who had effectively passed on us when we sent them the demo, by that time, when we went back to them again, it was a year later. And we're now the number one band in the area. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, Southern California being the magnet that it is for, you know, bands trying to get signed. And I'm not saying it because we did it, but, you know, this would be the case with any band. If you become the number one selling band in the area, there's pretty good chance you're probably the best selling band in the state of California. And if you're the best selling band in the state of California, there's a real good chance you're probably the best selling band in the United States, unsigned. And if that's the case, it's probably the same for the rest of the world. So they were paying attention to us by the point, but I think they thought we were a novelty. And then I get involved with Rod Smallwood, and because Maiden was already on the label. Maiden was nowhere near, you know, as big as they are now, but, you know, they were still, you know, a developing band. But, you know, that being said, with Rod, it was like a meeting in the minds. You know, I knew I had found my partner because at that moment, I was in serious negotiation with Bill O'Coin. And I knew Bill from having worked with Kiss and, you know, my friendship with Ace. And as a matter of fact, Ace and Bill came out here to see us on the second show we played at the Troubadour. And so I was 5 minutes away from signing that deal with Bill. And like I said, I met Rod, and it was just like, I knew I had found my partner. And the rest, you know. So, you know, we went back to Capitol, and I think, you know, the idea of them seeing that we had management, that they had confidence in, we go from almost signing a deal with an independent label for $75,000 to signing the largest deal in history for any previously unsigned band. It was for $2.5 million. And that was $2.5 million then.
Wow.
That was a lot of money back then.
It's interesting though, like just the idea that you're sitting there going, we need at least $75,000. Where'd that dollar figure come from?
Well, we figured, you know, to get us on the road, to be able to tour, some tour support, because quite honestly, my desire to go back and re-record it, I had no desire to do that. And that leads me, we actually ended up demoing that record 3 times before we recorded it. In my opinion, the demos are better than the record. And we're talking right now about trying to get a package together to release those demos in the very near future. Because, like I said, in my opinion, there's an energy on those that is pretty exciting. By the time we got to making the record, we had done it so many times that it had lost a lot of that newness, you know, the electricity that you have when you're first putting something together.
Sure.
And it wasn't as edgy as it was, especially that third set of demos. By the time we got to that, that's where it peaked. So, like I said, I didn't have any desire to go back and re-record it. And we would have taken the money and put it in tour support. But we signed the deal with Capitol. They want to own the masters. Knowing what I know now, I would have fought them on it. I would not have re-recorded it. We would have said, here's the demos. Use these.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it didn't happen. And but that's 2020 hindsight, because you learn as you go.
So when do you realize that there's a problem with Animal and it's going to be an issue putting it on the record?
When EMI calls and says that the three heads of EMI over in London got a letter from what's called the Queen's Council, which would be the equivalent of our Congress here. They got a letter saying that if they released that record, they were going to jail for 28 days each. Oof. And they had, I mean, you got to remember, this is the label that has the Beatles. You know, these guys are not going to jail for a rock band. And an odd thing happened. They stepped aside and let Music for Nations do it. And I don't know if there's ever been a case where once a group or an artist was signed to a major label, that label stepped aside and let someone else come in and do, you know, release a record that they had the rights to.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't know if that's ever happened. I don't think it has.
If you don't know this, like, you know, you hear I Want to Be Somebody, and that, you know, it's a great opening tune on the album. But for you, you had a sequence in mind that had to be pretty devastating. The idea of, you know, that song has to come off the record, and suddenly your album sequence that you have, like, you have to rethink it.
Well, we were also at that time still playing around with running orders and things,
yeah.
You know, so we didn't have anything written in stone, so to speak, you know, about how the set would be put together. I mean, we were still playing around with that. And quite honestly, Animal was not part of our original set where when we were still playing, you know, clubs and things like that. We debuted Animal. when we played the Santa Monica Civic that night. And I remember thinking to myself, when we played it, the audience, there was no reaction to it. They just stood there. And I thought, you know, I thought the song was pretty good. And I got no reaction, and I thought, this is a dud, you know. And what I didn't realize, you know, they were going, you know, they had already heard Love Machine and I Want to Be Somebody and all those things for a year. You know, and that fan base that we had knew those songs already, even though they didn't have them on record. You know, they knew them enough from coming to the shows. So we're playing a song that they don't know, and we got no reaction. And a funny thing happened when we did Headless, which, as I was saying before, was about 5 years down the road. We were playing a charity benefit, and it was at the Santa Monica Civic. And we did three songs that night, and one of them was The Real Me. And Headless had not been released yet. And the same exact thing happened. I forget which three songs we played. I mean, probably Texas and I Want to Be Somebody, I would think. I don't know. Could maybe Love Machine. Something people would have known.
Yeah.
But when we played The Real Me, stone cold nothing. You know, and I remember thinking, all right, don't get bent out of shape. You remember what happened when you played Animal here the first time? You know, and it was the same thing because, you know, Real Me ends up being a big hit for us. You know, but that's a strange reaction when you're used to getting reaction from an audience and then nothing. And you think, oh, man, you know, have we seriously missed the boat here?
It's also probably conflicting because then you have other songs that, like, as you know, like you play them and maybe the crowd hasn't heard them and they just go nuts. And that's a whole different thing. Like you can get kind of stuck on that.
Well, we were also in a period where bands didn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, if you went to a show in the early 70s, I mean, I really started going to shows about 73. And that was at the tail end of when bands would come out and do extended versions of whatever song they had. They'd do a 20-minute version of it, right?
Yeah.
And but also they would do material that a lot of times hadn't even been released yet. And that was common. You know, but because bands could release or could play things that had not yet been released because there was no bootlegging, not to speak of.
Yeah.
I mean, cassette tapes weren't really even in vogue yet, you know, so bands had a lot of freedom to basically test songs out to see what kind of reaction they got. I remember specifically, it was 1972, I went to see Alice Cooper doing Killer. And on the Killer tour, and they went, you know, did the main part of the show, went off, came back for the encore, and they started out with this song, and I thought, wow, this song's pretty cool. You know, I had never heard it before. I mean, I knew the first two records well.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then they're playing this new song, and then it got to the middle part of the song, and it goes, no more teachers, no more books, no more dirty looks. And I, you know, you know, it's an old kid's rhyme, you know, when you're in school. And I thought, okay, this is a joke song. But, you know, I still remember thinking, you know, the first part of that song was pretty cool. Then they release it, a week later and it schools out. You know, but that's the things that bands could do in those days. And you just, by the time the 80s came along, audiences just weren't used to that anymore.
Yeah.
So if they didn't know it, it was hard to get reaction.
What are you looking forward to the most about this upcoming tour?
My head is so deep into the show right now. I don't know if I can honestly answer that.
Yeah.
Because I just got off the phone with somebody that's building something for us right now. And, you know, so that's where my head is right now is putting this show together. You know, so if this thing ends up being what we hope it's going to be, it's going to be pretty cool. You know, so like I said, that's kind of where my head is at this moment. You know, once everything is set up and ready to go, then ask me that question, then I might give you a different answer.
Yeah, that's the way it goes with any sort of creative thing. I get that.
Yeah, you know, yeah, you got to have your head in the moment.
Well, I mean, you've obviously seen, you know, all the press from the touring that you did in the past year. And, you know, certainly you've, like, I think, dealt with this across your career. But, like, if, you know, you address just the question of, you know, using tapes and tracks and how much you were using and why and all that kind of stuff. So you've taken the knocks, you've addressed it, but there's still people going, none of this is live. Like, how do you feel when you hear that?
Well, if they're crazy enough to believe that, that's their business, you know, but if they genuinely feel like that, then don't go. You know, listen, God blessed me with this foghorn in my throat.
Yeah.
And like anybody who's got one, we like showing them off. And I'm no different. You know, and it's like, there'll be, I mean, I'm sorry if this sounds arrogant, but there will be times where I'm up there and I hear what's coming out of me when I'm sustaining a note or something and thinking to myself, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, and it's, I'm not sure everybody or most people would have the opportunity to experience something like that in their lives.
Yeah.
So yeah. From my perspective, I'm pretty appreciative of it. And like I said, you know, if you got this thing that really not a lot of people can do, you like to show it, you know? So I'll just leave it at that.
Sure.
You know, and listen, well, no, let me add one other thing.
Sure.
I grew up listening to Live at Leeds. And Live at Leeds was, even though I didn't realize it at the time, there are overdubs on it. But it's pretty raw. And it sounds like it was done by a three-piece band.
Yeah.
And for the most part, it's pretty realistic. But they don't do it like that anymore. They give, what they were doing was giving you a reflection of 1969. Because that's when that, well, I think it was recorded in 70. You know, Tommy came out in 69, I think. But whatever, you know, right around that, they were giving you a snapshot of that time frame. And that's what bands did. But when technology changed and we had the ability to make it sound bigger and better, who's not going to do that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can do the Live at Leeds version. We used to. Was it good? It was okay for what it was. But, you know, if I'm going to see a show, and this is my personal opinion, I want that thing to sound like the record. You know, so if, and I don't care what Queen says or any of these other bands, you know, oh, you know, we're doing that. No, you don't have 20 guys behind that stage singing. You just don't. You know, it's like they're all getting help out there. And you know what? The bottom line is to give the audience a good show. Who yeah. cares how it gets there? You know, it's like there's the argument that some of these girl singers out here now, you know, they don't sing a note. They probably don't. That, hey, listen, if I'm going to go see Yngwie, I want to see Yngwie play.
Yeah, sure.
You know, but there are some guys in some rock bands, if they didn't care, if they didn't play and it was recorded, it wouldn't bother me one iota because I'm not going there to see that. I would be going to hear the songs
yeah.
or something like that. But, you know, if somebody's got, you know, a dangerous instrument that they're really good at and could do something that few people can do, yeah, I want to hear them do it. You know, so in my opinion, I'm giving them that. But I'm also giving them the best of both worlds.
Well, last couple things here. One of my favorite videos from that you guys did back in the day is Blind in Texas. I wondered, what are your memories of doing that video and, you know, coming up with the concept and so on? Because it's a very visual video.
Well, it, you know, the lyrics, you know, really, it wrote itself. And we were approached by the company that did it. We ended up basically, we started our own video company and we stole all those guys. It was the same guys that did Hot for Teacher and they'd done the making a Thriller for Michael Jackson. You know, I mean, these guys were pros. And so we sat down and we hammered out a concept and we went to Tucson, Arizona. And there's a movie studio out there called Old Tucson. where they shoot Westerns and things like that. It's an old Western movie set. And we were there for 3 days, and quite honestly, it was a life-altering experience for me because, you know, being part Native American, and but growing up in New York, you know, I didn't really identify with that part of myself until I spent those 3 days there doing that video. And I fell in love with the Native American Indian culture. And I heard Billy Crystal say the same thing when he did City Slickers. You know, when he got out there and, you know, you get in tune with all that and it changes you. And, you know, because another New York kid, you know, the only thing we know is the Yankees and the subway and pizza, you know. So it's like not until you really get entrenched in some other culture and you look around and you go, wow, you know, I could hang here for a while. This is pretty cool. Look what I've been missing.
Hell Dorado is one of the few Wasp albums that's not on streaming. Why is that?
That would be a record company question.
As so many things are, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, final record company question, or record question specifically. Where are things at with this new Wasp album you've had taking shape?
We worked on it a lot. And then we went and we did the tour last year, and I came home. And as you know, I was having problems with my back and stuff. So I had a lot of time, you know, in between the surgeries just to sit and twiddle my thumbs. And I did a lot of listening to what we had done already, and I'm just not that thrilled with it. You know, it's, I think there's some of it, I think there's moments that are really good, but it's not consistent.
Yeah.
You know, and I might be going off track here a little bit, but I think I was trying to steer it in a direction it didn't want to go. Remember what I said early on in the beginning about, you know, when you've been doing this long enough, you recognize the get out of the way and let it go where it wants to go.
Sure.
Well, yeah. I was deliberately trying to steer it somewhere it didn't want to go. And it turns around and it bites you because of it, you know. And so I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board on that. But I'm not going to, you know, pour it down the drain. Because there's stuff there that's definitely good, but it's not a cohesive package yet. Not to the point of where I would want it now, because, you know, you got to remember that every record we do now, it's about legacy.
Sure.
You know, it's not about, you know, how many records can you sell nowadays, because, you know, you're going up against your past. Every time you do a new record now, it's your opening act.
Yeah.
Because it has to go up against all those songs that people have romanced in their heads for however long. And for those new songs to stand up against older material, quite honestly, they have to be better than the old material just to have a chance to survive.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing that, I just want it to be the best it can be. You know, I mean, I did that with Golgotha. You know, it's like, Golgotha is a good record. You know, and it just, but you have to put in the work, you know, to get it like that. I mean, I approached that record as if, you know, it was still on EMI, you know, and that's the mindset you have to have. You cannot worry about sales. You know, those days are over, you know, so it's all about legacy. And do you want to do something that's going to taint your legacy? I don't. You know, if I'm going to do it, I want to do it right.
Well, Blackie, always a pleasure to speak with you, man. I'll let you run on to the next thing, but thank you for the time.
Well, thanks, man. I sure appreciate it, bud. You take care now.
Likewise, man. Bye-bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.